Welcome to another episode of Fit to Teach, where every Monday we provide evidence-based health and wellness information to support teachers and school employees on their wellness journey. My name is Kyle Favenbach. I'm an associate professor of health and human performance at Eastern Oregon University and director of the EOU Lab for Exercise Assessment and Performance, which we call the LEAP. I'm joined by LEAP intern Cole. What's up, Cole?
What's up, Dr. Kyle?
How are you doing?
I'm doing all right.
Good.
How about
you? I'm fired up. I want to talk about insulin.
Yeah.
For Fit to Teach each week, we provide a summary of a research paper that provides insight into some aspect of health and wellness, and we also suggest an achievable action item that teachers and staff can focus on for the week. The goal is that by trying these activities throughout each week, that healthy habits will accumulate, and you can find out what health and wellness activities are a good fit for you. Let's get into this week's paper. So this week, we are doing a paper called Understanding Insulin Actions Beyond Glycemic Control, a narrative review. This is a group out of Poland, actually, but they did a really good job. And what I like about narrative reviews, so there's a couple different types of reviews and review papers. What I like about reviews, and we've talked about this before, so it's a scientific paper written by experts in the field, and it essentially puts together information from a variety of different studies to tell a story about the current state of a field, or it introduces a new idea that needs more research, or there's a variety of different roles it has. There's different types of reviews. There's reviews that are called systemic reviews, which are like they have this very systematic way of identifying papers that they analyze. There's also reviews called meta-analysis, which actually combine all the subjects and statistics and results from different fields or from different studies to create an overall, is there an effect overall in a bunch of different studies that study some topic in different ways. And then there's reviews like this, which are narrative reviews, which are just smart people that think a topic needs more attention. They're following the developments in the research, like the independent research, individual studies, and then they put it all together and basically just give their, it's not an op-ed in terms of opinion. It's more of, this is the research and this is our interpretation of the research right now. And I think these are extremely valuable. I've had the opportunity to write one or two, and it was a really good just way to get down into the science and figure out how to tell a story. And I thought this did a really good job. And the reason why I wanted to talk about it is a fundamental thing that I talk about a lot when I'm giving nutrition talks, when I'm talking to folks in the community, when I'm talking to teachers, when I'm talking to firefighters, when I'm talking to anybody, even athletes, when I'm talking to anybody about nutrition, I think one of the most kind of, it's not a misunderstanding, it's just a lack of appreciation for the diverse roles that the hormone insulin has. A lot of people have heard of insulin. And if you ask them what's insulin do, they say it controls blood sugar. And we know it's associated with diabetes. Type 1 diabetes is typically early onset, and that's where your pancreas, it's an autoimmune disorder. So your immune system attacks your pancreas, and your pancreas no longer produces insulin. So you have to use exogenous sources of insulin, synthetic insulin, essentially. We know a lot about it. We can control blood sugar really well. They have automated insulin pumps now. There's a bunch of really cool tools. The other form of diabetes, type 2 diabetes, this is where, for a variety of different reasons, and maybe we'll unpack some of those today, we can do another podcast on this topic because there's just so much to discuss. But for type 2 diabetes, what you're looking at is a scenario where the individual is becoming resistant to the action of insulin. And there's a variety of reasons why this occurs, but a lot of people get fixated on a blood sugar number because blood sugar is really easy to measure. People can measure it at home. You can measure it with a little finger prick. You can measure it with a continuous glucose monitor. And essentially what happens when you're resistant to the action of insulin, you have your blood sugar is too high too often for too long. And this in and of itself has quite a few health complications, but it's really more indicative of broader issues, because what it suggests is we're using glucose, high blood glucose. Our body can deal with it pretty well for a pretty significant amount of time. The real detriment in this condition is that if insulin isn't working the way that it's supposed to work, it has broad effects, because insulin does so much more than just regulate blood sugar. And what's cool about insulin is it's fully regulated. It's largely regulated by the food that we eat and when we eat that food. And it is an example of where the nutrients that you consume are a signal for insulin release. And depending on the food that you eat, the timing of it, and a bunch of other factors, blood sugar goes up, you're at rest, insulin goes up. Insulin does a whole bunch of different things that are usually related to being at rest and in a fed state. And so it's this really important hormone that isn't regulated in the way other hormones are, where like your testosterone goes up and down throughout the day based on your biological clock. Your cortisol goes up and down throughout the day based on both your circadian rhythm or biological clock, but also like how much stress you're under. There's a bunch of different hormones that are regulated throughout the day in different ways. Insulin's unique because it's regulated by the food that we eat. And so I think it's really important to have a good understanding of what insulin is, how it works, and all the different things that it does, so that we really know the implications of what is happening based on the food that we're eating and when we're eating it. So that's the overview. And the paper does a really good job of discussing what are all the things outside of regulating blood glucose that insulin does and insulin has an impact on.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that was a really nice opening and overview.
Oh, you kind.
No, but like...
I hit the clap button.
So I think you did a really good job. But my first question to go along with that and to go along with the title of this article is, beyond regulating blood glucose, what are some of the most significant roles insulin has that are currently like underappreciated? So the article talks about the influence on bone and muscle and central nervous system. So I'd like you to just touch on some of those a little bit.
Yeah. So this is what I think there's two things that people are going to be most interested in knowing about when it comes to the roles of insulin outside of blood sugar regulation. The first is around growth and recovery and protein synthesis. And it makes a lot of sense when you break it down and you think about it. What is insulin? When is it released? And why does it make sense that it's a really powerful growth hormone? Well, why is that? When you consume food that has carbohydrates in it, those carbohydrates go down into your gut. They go through your stomach and into your gut, into your small intestine. They get broken down into individual sugars and they enter your bloodstream. As they enter your bloodstream, your blood sugar rises. The rise in blood sugar signals the pancreas to release insulin. Now, insulin is only released when we're at rest and we have high blood sugar. So the key are those two things. We have a lot of energy and we're not doing any physical work. So the conditions are ripe for growth. So it makes a lot of sense that you would tie insulin to a bunch of different growth processes that are really important. You especially get a big jump in growth processes when you consume carbohydrates and you release insulin in the post-exercise state. This also makes a lot of sense. If you go back to like our roots and our hunter-gathering days, if you're out doing a bunch of physical work, you're either running from something or you're hunting something. And when you are successful at that and you consume the rewards of that, whether that was gathering, whether that was harvesting, whether that was hunting successfully, and now you consume carbohydrates, you want to take advantage of one, you want to get better at the thing that just got you the thing that you were working towards. So this is where you get super compensation. Your body overdoes the response to the stimulus. That's why we get into shape when we do some exercise, we recover, we have the capacity to do a little bit more exercise. This is the term people use for getting into shape. So I think growth processes are really important to understand when it comes to insulin, because one of the theories, for example, around type 2 diabetes is that when cells are getting bombarded with signals to grow and lots of energy, i.e. high blood sugar, but they have nothing to respond to because the individual hasn't been exercising or hasn't been doing physical work, it's actually can become pretty detrimental. You don't want just like tons and tons of growth with nothing to respond or grow to. And so what happens, one of the theories is that becoming resistant to the action of insulin, i.e. type 2 diabetes, is actually initially a protective mechanism to protect your cells from getting bombarded with all these growth signals without having growth. And what are the things that cause type 2 diabetes? Overconsumption of food, overconsumption of carbohydrates, excess energy balance, so you're taking on more calories than you're burning, and a lack of exercise. And it makes a lot of sense under those circumstances. You're bombarding the system with growth, but you haven't done anything to respond to. And so that's a really important point to understand in terms of insulin is a growth signal, and we don't want uncontrolled growth, especially when we're not responding to things. So that's really important. The second thing that I think is really important that for people to understand is that insulin is a signal that we have a lot of energy in the system and we have a lot of carbohydrates in the system. And under those circumstances, we want to utilize the energy that we have that's a fast preferred energy, which is carbohydrate, and we want to save our energy reserves that are our long-term sort of backup plan for providing us with energy as we go between meals, which is fat. So what is happening under these circumstances is that when insulin is up in the system, means we have a lot of the preferred substrate that we want, which is carbohydrate, and we're at rest, which means we can save our fat. So one of the things that insulin does is it actually promotes fat storage and it suppresses fat breakdown. And so a lot of people have the misconception that they gain body fat when they're overeating and when they're overeating on carbohydrates, but it's actually not really the case. The misperception is that the excess carbohydrates get converted to fat. Humans don't do that all that well, at least in terms of their adiposity, their body fat. Like, we convert some of those sugars into fat in the liver. We do that pretty well, but we don't convert a lot of carbohydrates into fat in a way that contributes to our adiposity. Why people gain fat under those conditions is that they are always overfed. They always have the substrate that the body would prefer to have, which is carbohydrates. And it's not necessarily what it needs. It's what it would prefer. If they're in the system, the body's going to burn them. So they just never burn any of their body fat. So the fat that they're consuming continues to be stored away, never gets burned, never gets used. And this is one of the reasons why lower carbohydrate, higher protein diets can be effective for weight loss, because it forces your body to use more fat as a fuel because it has less carbohydrates available to it. So anytime you drink a non-diet soda, let's say, so you stop at shortstop, it's 10 o'clock, let's say you ate breakfast at 7:30 or 8, you had a nice little insulin spike, you used some carbohydrate, stored some fat, you used up your carbohydrate. Now as blood sugar starts to drop again and level out, one of the mistakes that people make is that they'll just grab a Coke for example, and then they drink this Coke down, that causes this unnecessary spike in blood sugar in the middle of the day that isn't associated with a meal. And now during a time when they could be burning fat as a fuel, they're just burning the sugar from the Coke and they're sparing the fat they're burning. So those are the two kind of major things that I think most people want to know about in regards to this. And it's also a really good explanation for why lower carbohydrate diets tend to work for people that are recreationally active, not like hard training elite athletes or hard training athletes.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's really interesting. And one of the questions I have piggybacks off that a little bit is from taking sports nutrition classes with you and talking about the importance of insulin in that post-workout recovery shake. I want to know what the role insulin plays in the post-workout recovery when you're getting that 3-to-1 or 4-to-1 carb to protein ratio that's recommended and the role it has in facilitating anabolic pathways post-workout and the importance of that. And maybe how 4-to-1 or 3-to-1 isn't necessarily what some people want if they're trying to lose weight or whatever else. So,
yeah, I think these are great points, like really good points. So basically, one of the things that we talk about in sports nutrition a lot is that in hard training individuals, the goal is to be able to train, to adapt to that training, recover from that training so that a person can train hard again and get quality training in multiple times a week and get the benefits of that. So let's say a runner does a 1-hour run, he or she does a 1-hour run, and let's say there's 2 times 10 minutes where they run really hard and then 5 minutes off or something like that. So it's this big dynamic workout. They're burning a lot of calories. They're exerting a lot of effort. And they're doing that workout because they want adaptation to a specific system. And so you stimulate the system with the workout. And then to take advantage of that workout, you have to recover from it. So one of the things that we talk a lot about with our athletes is we'll take in, say, 20 grams of protein and 60 grams of carbohydrate. That's the 3-to-1 ratio that you're referencing. And what that does is it puts some of the building blocks that we need for recovery. That's the amino acids. That's the protein. Puts those into the bloodstream and those into the system. The carbohydrates, a lot of times are thought of as, oh, we need to replenish our sugar and replenish the storage form of our sugar. I think that's secondary. I think the reason why you want carbohydrates is so that you can increase insulin. And when you increase insulin, in the post-exercise state, your body is very sensitive to insulin, more so than when you're just sitting around. That's why exercise is like the number one thing a person can do to improve their blood sugar, is because exercise in and of itself increases your sensitivity to insulin. And that makes a lot of sense because your cells are trying to do the best that they can to recover and grow from the stimulus that was just applied. Now, for a lot of recreational people that are just maintaining, you walk 3 or 4 times a week, you lift weights a couple times a week, depending on their goals to lose weight, you still want some sort of recovery so that you can take advantage of the effort, but it doesn't need to be quite that much sugar. You're not looking to get like a huge insulin spike after you've done a 20-minute walk or something like that. So really what the point is of those types of activities is you want to burn fat, you want to stimulate the system, you want to get some training stimulus to the system. You do want to recover from it, but it's not quite as hard as a bigger workout. So you could do like a 1-to-1 ratio under those circumstances. So you get a little bit of nutrition afterwards and it's going to support recovery, but the intensity of it didn't really dictate just this full blown recovery response. So I'd say for most of the teachers that are living a busy life in an aging population that's trying to be as fit as possible, you definitely want to get some a little bit of protein and sugar after your workout each day. But you just want to time that maybe around a meal so you're not adding an extra insulin spike and blood glucose spike, but you're still getting a little bit of nutrition for recovery.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
So the intensity of the workout is what we really want to focus on in making that post-workout or post or that recovery shake, like determining how many grams per carbs you get.
And it's the intensity of the workout. It's also the goal. So if, I don't know, I just had a conversation with a guy who's 50 years old. He has super high metabolism. I know, hard life, but whatever. Just naturally has a really high metabolism. He actually wants to add muscle. He lifts 4 to 5 times a week. He's had a really hard time adding muscle. So for him, even though he's aging, even though he's not doing super intense workouts, I actually think like a 3 to 1 or 4 to 1 like dedicated recovery drink under those circumstances would allow him to add weight. A lot of people that are engaged in exercise programs are trying to lose weight, but we still have to fuel recovery to a certain degree. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So it's a little bit of a judgment call under those circumstances, and it's based on the individual, the goals of the individual. And the big thing that I see, the biggest obstacle I see to people trying to lose weight is they spike their insulin too often by spiking their blood sugar at random times. And that's just, this is one of the reasons why we don't really recommend fruit outside of meals, for example. Fruit has a lot of sugar. And so you think, yeah, whenever I get hungry at school, I eat a banana and an apple. Guess what? Like, you just spike sugar, you spiked insulin. You might not have a sugar crash the way you would if you ate a donut or a pastry or a bunch of candy or drank a soda, but you're still getting a rise in blood sugar, which causes a rise in insulin, which means you're suppressing fat and you're promoting fat synthesis and you're suppressing fat breakdown. This is just critical. It's a critical aspect to this. It's one of the reasons why one of the things that people like, they really take away when I do nutrition talks, I've heard a lot of feedback around this, is eat dessert with your dinner, for example. Because if you eat dinner, let's say you have baked potato and steak, that's got some sugar in it, it's got some protein in it, you're going to have an insulin curve, you're going to have a blood glucose curve. And then you say, I need to let my food settle for 45 minutes or an hour. That's just when all the hormone levels are coming back down to baseline. And then you eat a big piece of cake or a bowl of ice cream, and all of it spikes back up again. And the closer you do that to bedtime, the higher your sugar stays, the higher your insulin stays throughout the night. And insulin and sleep do not mix that well together because we're not supposed to be eating when we're sleeping.
So high carbohydrate meals right before bed are definitely not a thing you want to avoid.
Yeah, like carbohydrate only snacks are a thing that I would recommend people avoid because you're unnecessarily spiking insulin. So for example, we were tracking, so they have these tools called continuous glucose monitors, and we're working on actually getting it so that teachers can check these out from the lab. And basically what they do is they measure your blood sugar every 3 minutes, 24 hours a day. So you get a real clear picture of like how many times you're spiking your blood sugar and where your blood sugar is during exercise, during rest, during sleep, all those different types of things. For example, I had an athlete a couple of years ago. He had this habit of eating a huge bowl of cereal before he went to bed. One, I think he said, I'm always hungry, but he was under eating protein. Protein makes us feel full and it keeps us full for longer. And then I was also saying you need to eat more protein. And if you're going to eat these things, like, you need to eat it with your dinner. You need to have it like this, because this is a very fit athlete. And the cutoff for when you start getting, I want to be thinking about glucose a little bit more. I want to be a little concerned about the number of times I'm spiking blood sugar and what I'm doing, my habits around this, is around 100 mgs per deciliter. This is an elite athlete whose fasting blood sugar is in the 70s or 80s. But on the days when we put continuous glucose monitor on him, on the days when he ate cereal before he went to bed, his blood sugar did not go back below 100 until about 6 in the morning.
It's crazy.
You see what I'm saying? There, we have these tools and we have these insights now that are really cool, and they can just show you the data. You think, I'm going to have a bowl of fruit before I go to bed, and fruit's a healthy dessert, but you're spiking insulin, you're spiking sugar, and you're as you do that throughout the night, you're not using fat the way you should as a fuel source while you're sleeping, and you're promoting fat stores. So circulating lipids go up, there's all these different implications around it.
Yeah.
One thing I wanted to touch on, piggybacking off this conversation, is the role carbohydrates have taken before workout. And we've had this discussion a lot, like you're not going to perform as well using fat as you would using carbs. But for most people in the general population, taking carbs before that workout, you're not going to be burning the fat that they would like to be. So what's that kind of like, what are your recommendations? I guess it's all individual, like what they want.
Yeah, it's such a good question. It's a hard, so I think a critical piece of information that can help people visualize this and picture it is that there's this thing called the substrate of hierarchy, or the hierarchy of substrate metabolism. And all that means is if you ate a meal that had protein, fat, and carbohydrates in it, what would your body choose to burn first? So top of the list is actually what? Alcohol. So if you drink alcohol, everything else goes on the back burner. Your body focuses on metabolizing the alcohol. After that, it's carbohydrates, then fat, then protein. So if it's a choice between burning carbohydrates and burning fat, your body's going to choose to burn carbohydrates. Now, from a performance standpoint, we need carbohydrates for high intensity exercise. So if you're going to go set your PR for 5K, you better be carbed up in your meals before that. And then I would even recommend eating some sugar within 5 minutes of your warm up or 5 minutes of the start of the race. The reason why that 5 minutes is important is that when we exercise, this is tricky, but when we exercise, blood sugar goes up, insulin goes down. So it is muscle contraction that stimulates the muscles to take in glucose when we're exercising, not insulin. This is like a super critical point, which brings us back to our original discussion, which is that insulin is only released when we're at rest and we have high blood sugar. Okay. So the best way to control your blood sugar, if you want to eat a candy bar, is to eat the candy bar and go for a walk. Because you're not burning fat, you're burning the sugar from the candy bar, but at least you're not spiking your blood sugar in a way that's causing a big insulin release. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So a lot of people employ this. They'll eat dinner and then go for a 20-minute walk, something like that. It's super effective. Now, back to your question, if your goal for a workout is to burn fat and it's a moderate workout, you have to put your body in a position to burn that fat. And the way to do that is by limiting the amount of carbohydrates that you take in prior to that. And then you'll force your body to use more fat as a fuel. Now, will you feel great? Not a lot of the times, especially if you're pushing hills or you're trying to run really hard or you're trying to do stuff really hard. That's that intensity piece of it. But if you're going for a walk and you do your walk first thing in the morning in a fasted state, you're burning a lot of fat under those circumstances. And that can be a great method for losing body fat.
Gotcha. Switching gears a little bit.
Sure.
I want to talk about the role it has in like reproductive health.
Sure.
The article talked about that a little bit. And so like, I want to know what role insulin plays in reproductive health and how my insulin resistance influence fertility issues such as PCOS, which the article mentioned a couple of different times. But
anytime you delve into this, like away from the day-to-day nutrition world and into the medical world, we just need to like really importantly say, we're not doctors, we're not physicians, we're not giving medical advice here. This is just like talking about science. And it's a really interesting question because insulin is such a powerful growth hormone, and because so many tissues have insulin receptors, under like never releasing insulin has implications in a bunch of different ways. Overproduction of insulin also has a lot of implications. So things like polycystic ovarian syndrome is related to insulin resistance. And we think those things are not just correlated, but there could be a part of the reason why PCOS occurred is because of too much insulin in the system. And then in like basically insulin resistance wasn't able to protect against it. Does that make sense? So we have these cells, your brain has insulin. So the article talks a lot about cognition and the importance of in the relationship, the high relationship between cognitive decline and diseases like Alzheimer's disease, along with type 2 diabetes. Those things often go hand in hand. And this is why type 2 diabetes is never the only thing that a person has. A person with type 2 diabetes is very likely to be in a condition of what we call metabolic syndrome, which is basically multiple chronic diseases all in type 2 diabetes is one of those conditions. So we often see things like high blood pressure, atherosclerosis, obesity, sedentary, and type 2 diabetes all together. And those things are also all positively associated with things like Alzheimer's disease or lower cognition or gestational diabetes or these like negative implications on reproductive organs. And so it just goes back to show you how critical modulating insulin is to a person's healthy lifestyle. And we just don't talk about it enough, because we only think of it as like a blood sugar thing, and it just isn't. And again, insulin is released when there's high blood sugar and we're at rest. We can increase our sensitivity to insulin by exercising. We can reduce our reliance on insulin by exercising. We can increase our ability to adapt to exercise by utilizing post-exercise nutrition, which releases insulin. We can manage the amount of time that we spend in a hyperinsulinemic state by picking and choosing when we have carbohydrates throughout the day. And you really want to limit your insulin spikes to 2-3 at the most for a person that's recreationally active. For athletes, especially athletes that are in sports that require a certain amount of leanness, runners, wrestlers, cyclists, we try and keep insulin spikes to 4 a day, 3 meals plus a recovery drink. For people operating under like regular conditions, throw in 1 meal per day that has 0 carbohydrates. Avoid random blood sugar and insulin spikes throughout the day, and get the sugar that your brain needs and your brain thrives on in 2 meals.
Gotcha.
Yeah. And your brain needs about 130 grams of, I think the RDA for adults for carbohydrate is 130 grams per day. Most people are getting well over 300 grams, sometimes 500 grams per day, especially when you start throwing in. We do experiments for this in the lab. Hop over and grab that Coke. Tell me how many grams of carbohydrates are in that. So we have junk food in the lab so that we can do experiments on blood sugar and show the students. Oh, say it in the mic.
55 grams.
Yeah. So you need 130 grams of carbohydrates per day, right? That's 2 pieces of, so let's say you eat 120 grams of carbohydrates per day. That's 2 pieces of bread at 3 meals is 120 grams. You can get almost half that by drinking a Coke just randomly.
Yeah.
Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's crazy. So you touched on it, but like my next question was, well, so are lifestyle changes and diet, like with diet and exercise, are those the best way to improve insulin sensitivity? And
yeah, man. So there's a couple things here. One is that there's a big genetic component to a person's insulin regulation and insulin sensitivity. It's just a fact. And so type 2 diabetes is a big hereditary component to it. If people in your family have type 2 diabetes, it's likely that you're at risk to get type 2 diabetes. It's just, that's the way it is. So there's a large genetic component that has to be taken into consideration. It's not always related to obesity either. They're lean individuals that don't exercise, don't regulate their insulin well, and have the genetics to become insulin resistant, and they can develop this as well. So it's not just I have gained a bunch of weight and now I'm insulin resistant. The two, they are related, but they don't, one doesn't have to be there for the other one.
Okay.
The second thing to be aware of, so one, your genetic susceptibility to this. The second thing is the types and forms of sugars that you're consuming. So anytime you're consuming like simple sugars, candy, Coke, those types of things, those things are going to increase your blood sugar at a much more rapid rate. And when blood sugar spikes really high, insulin also spikes really high. So that is hard on the system where, and these are foods that didn't exist when we evolved these systems. Does that make sense? So the systems weren't evolved to take in 55 grams of sugar in 2 seconds. And so it's hard on the system in that way. So that's another consideration. Think about the types of sugars that you're eating. The more fiber and the more protein that are in mixed meals, the lower your blood sugar is, means the lower your insulin is. So you want to think about getting mixed meals, not just carbohydrate alone meals. Just had a conversation with a client who was like, yeah, when I get in a hurry and then I just eat a thing of ramen noodles and there's no protein, there's no fiber, there's no greens, and that's just an insulin spike. That's a blood glucose spike. That's an insulin spike. Even though it's part of a meal, it's still like hard on the body because we just do better when we mix our meals and when we eat healthy food. So I think really understanding what are the contents of your meals, how much carbohydrate are you consuming and how much do you need, how much hidden sugar are you consuming throughout the day? So hang on. Okay, 3, 2, 1, back. How much hidden sugar that you're consuming throughout the day and just random, that's really important to be, to, and we're not, I think it's really important to find sustainable ways to, and rules are not sustainable. So it is, you don't want to create such strict rules that there's no way that you can sustain them. But awareness, and we've talked about this a lot, like awareness of what you're eating, when you're eating, and why you're eating it, is just so important. And so I think raising awareness around, am I spiking insulin? Is that necessary? Am I getting my dessert with my meal? Did I have a nice mixed meal with lots of protein and complex carbohydrates? Now I'm going to indulge. What do I want out of this workout? What do I need out of the recovery from this workout? If you can understand this concept, it really shapes a lot of the approach already. Yeah. So it's not diet and exercise in terms of some sort of fad diet or some sort of process or some sort of thing. It's just awareness around what insulin does and that it's way more than just a glucose regulator.
Great. That
one more. Or are you done?
No, I have one more.
Yeah. Let's do one more and then we'll wrap it up.
My last question was going to be, what are some emerging therapies or research avenues that might modify how we are under, or how we understand insulin and what implications those might have in the future?
Yeah, I think this is really cool and it's unknown and it's the billions of dollar question. I want to go back real quick. One of the other things that people, simple sugars and carbohydrates are very desirable. And food companies know this, and marketing departments know this. And one of the reasons why, if you're an individual that hasn't learned the associations around insulin and its implications and blood sugar and like the role that it has in suppressing fat breakdown and all those different types of things. So if you haven't learned those aspects or become aware of those aspects yet, you may not be aware of what you're doing when you're doing it, when you're consuming something. And then 2, 3, two or three, I forget what I'm on now. You're getting marketed all the time to indulge in this and that, or like you just stop, you prepay for gas and you're just hit with all these super desirable things. Like you're thirsty and you don't want water. So what do? And raising awareness around that, I think, is one of the most important things people can do for their long-term health so that they understand what the implications are. Now, as long as it's a conscious decision, people can do what they want, right? It's where I get the ick is like when they manipulate people into over-consuming without them processing what they're, it's not a conscious decision at that point. It's just a reaction. Oh yeah, Coke does sound good right now. Bam. And then your insulin, it's off to the races. And so I think those things are like really important in terms of like application of this information.
Absolutely.
Moving forward, this is like where a lot of my college, like I studied insulin, insulin metabolism, insulin dynamics, the impact of insulin on different cellular pathways was like the basis of my work as a doctoral student. It was a really important part of my master's thesis. It was also played a really important role in what I did as a fellow at USC. And because insulin and sugar and those types of things are also what cancer likes, because it is the energy source that cancer has to run on. Cancer is pretty crappy at using fat as a fuel. It craves sugar. And of course, sugar is related with high growth and high growth rates. So tumors love insulin as well. So there's a lot of research around those types of things. And again, like just always hitting the system with lots of energy and lots of growth signals is not always in the best interest of the system. Moving forward, there's a lot of really interesting drugs like your GLP-1 inhibitors. So things like Ozempic, and there's several classes of these various drugs that appear to help people achieve weight loss, help lower A1C level, which is a long-term indicator. High A1C is a long-term indicator of high circulating blood sugar. It's used as a marker for type 2 diabetes. And so there's a race to unlock that. It's essentially an exercise mimetic. It's a race to unlock the pill that allows people to manage the negative effects of things like insulin and blood sugar through manipulating their cellular metabolism with a drug instead of with conscious eating and exercise. And again, these are amazing drugs, and they're going to have potentially, we don't know. There's a lot of people taking these drugs, and we don't know what it's going to look like after they've taken them for 10 years or 15 years or that. Science takes a long time. It takes a long time to fully understand the implications of different things. There's a lot of drug companies that are researching these types of things, and we can do, people can email us if they want to, if you want us to break down like the effects of this conversation sets the stage for a lot of different topics that we can talk about moving forward, because a lot of things affect insulin, and including diet, including exercise, including sleep, your biological rhythms, your circadian rhythms. There's a whole field of nutrition called chrononutrition, which is about the timing of when you eat, how that affects our health and our body and our sleep and our daily rhythms. And there's just so many interesting things, and which is why a paper like this is so important, because it really gets people thinking about, oh man, I just thought that was the type 2 diabetes hormone, and I thought it was just related to glucose. And you realize, no, this thing has really far-reaching and important impact. And yeah, I don't stay up on the drug side of things as much as I probably should. I can research it and look into it. I'm aware of these things. And my colleague, he was actually a roommate of mine at Colorado State. He's now a professor at Oregon State, and they're about a year into a clinical trial. It was the first human clinical trial that had ever been approved at Oregon State, history of their university. And he is basically uncovering the mechanism by which a different type of drug, not the GLP-1 inhibitor, but a different type of drug, it essentially tells your, I think it's called SGL2 something, but it basically tells your kidneys not to hold on to as much of the glucose that they see. So the idea is that you pee out a bunch of glucose and you control your blood sugar by peeing out more glucose throughout the day. But the positive effects on insulin sensitivity and the positive effects on weight loss and the positive effects when people take these drugs cannot be attributed to the amount of glucose that they're losing in their urine. So he's basically identified the cellular mechanisms and he's in the process of discovering the other impact that these drugs have on muscles and other things that we didn't know when the drug was developed and put into use. But now we're uncovering, and it's all related to aspects of skeletal muscle that exercise does on its own. And it's a really, it just shows you how far-reaching and important exercise is, because you'd have to take a cocktail of thousands of drugs to try and recreate all the like amazing things that exercise does to the body in terms of regulating these things. When he says, show me someone with prediabetes and an exercise bike, and I'll show you a metabolically healthy person in 3 weeks. And it happens immediately. He actually published a study back when he was a doctoral student at the University of that team up north, Michigan. We don't even say that in my house. We say Ishigan. But that team up north obviously is like amazing academic institution. That's where his name's Sean Newsom. That's where he got his PhD. And he published a paper there where he showed that individuals could improve their insulin sensitivity to the level of a healthy college-aged person. These are morbidly obese individuals that have massively high body fat percentages, significant insulin resistance, and he could significantly improve that with 3 days of walking on a treadmill. It's like 45 minutes at 3 miles an hour for 3 days.
Wow.
It happens immediately.
Yeah.
And, but here's the flip side, which when I hear him give this talk, I just think it's such a cool part of his talk when he talks about this and presents this. The flip side is that when they took healthy, active, college-age individuals and they didn't exercise for 3 days, they started to take on the insulin and metabolic characteristics of an obese individual that didn't exercise. And he says, you can look at this as a pessimist or an optimist. The pessimist says, you mean I don't build up all this exercise credit that I can just take weeks off at a time with no, you can't do that because the absence of the signal is the signal, right? We've been talking about this in class. The optimist says, it doesn't matter how long I haven't exercised. I go out and I go for a walk and I do that every day. I get the benefits every single day and I get it after the first time that I do it. And then you accumulate those benefits over time. That's another thing we've been talking about a lot in class. So I think this as like, it's such an interesting way to talk about nutrition because you can solve, it takes out so many of the rules and all this other stuff. You create awareness around insulin. You create awareness around what you're eating, when you're eating it, why you're eating it. And you implement some form of physical activity 6 to 7 days a week. And we're just there. It will benefit us significantly. Now, there are like some genetic caveats to that and stuff like that, but for the vast majority of people, it's going to get them on the right path.
Awesome.
Cool.
I think we touched on a lot of what the paper talked about, and I think we gave some pretty valuable insights for everybody listening.
Hopefully. So,
yeah.
So it's got to be a little self-deprecating here.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Yeah.
So yeah, share with your friends, share with your family, you know, spread the word about the podcast. we're really happy to have these conversations. I love talking about this stuff. So I think it's really cool.
Yeah, it's awesome.
For teachers that do listen to it, that are interested in these types of assessments, learning more about insulin, learning more about the positive impacts of exercise, hit us up, humanperformancelab@eou.edu. You can email us questions that you'd like to hear on the podcast. You can schedule to come in and get your teacher testing. Again, that's all free. And we can continue these discussions in person and look at your individual physiology with our equipment here in our beautiful lab. Cool. All right. We'll see you next time. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.